Welcome to the Business of Health podcast, your go-to resource for practical insights on managing employee benefits and lowering healthcare costs. I'm your host, Mike Martins, and together we'll uncover strategies to enhance price stability and optimize your company's health benefits. Let's dive into the world of healthcare economics and tackle the challenges of the business of health. Well, it is a great day for another episode of Business of Health, and I appreciate all of you coming back and joining us. My gosh, our audience seems to grow every week, and I want to thank all of my guests and the topics and some of the people that my crew work to help me find folks that I know are going to generate interest in. We've got a great topic today. We're talking about small group benefit plans, and as most of you know, that's not my bailiwick because at First Staff Benefits, we are focused on Affordable Care Act compliance in that over 50 market. But that by no stretch is the majority of the businesses out there. And the challenges that are being faced by the business owners, the HR professionals, and the group insurance consultants to put together programs that work are tremendous. And we have an absolute expert today. Nancy Giacalone is, in addition to being a podcast host and a speaker, is the owner of Olympic Crest Insurance in Gig Harbor, Washington. I know if you've attended any benefit conferences recently, or maybe you're a LinkedIn junkie like I am, you've certainly heard Nancy speak or you've read her posts. Now, I also want to mention that she is one of the finalists for the Benefits Pro 2023 Broker of the Year Award. So we're on your team with that, Nancy. She's a disruptor. She's a maverick, and I'm excited to have her here. Welcome to the Business of Health.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, this whole small group market, and you and I have talked about this, Nancy, our sales channels are brokers and agents, and most of our producers work on both sides of the fence. They've got some large group business, and they have probably predominantly smaller group business. The challenge seems to be, in the feedback that I hear from them, is you've got bookshelf applications, which may or may not fit. And if they don't fit, you've really got to jump into some creativity. So share with me how, when you sit down with a small business owner for the first time and you're trying to assess what their needs are and what their hot buttons are, walk me through that process. How does that conversation go?
Sure. Well, let's start with a little background. So 92% of employers in the United States have less than 100 employees. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between 95 and 96% that have less than 50 employees. However, if you go talk to a business owner who has, let's say, 42 employees, let's just pick a number, they don't look at themselves as a small business.
Of course not.
They have worked hard to grow themselves to that point in time, to where they are now. They've scaled, they have created efficiencies. They feel really good about what they've accomplished. And as an industry, we've labeled them, partly due to the ACA and the Affordable Care Act, but we've labeled them, "You're a small business." And essentially said to them, you don't count. I mean, and I think we have to remember that. It's a lot different conversation when you're talking with an employer with three or four employees. They know they're a small business. But we're going, and in some states, remember that that cutoff is 100. So mm-hmm. Many you're talking to an employer with 78 employees, not a small business to them. They might have three or four offices with employees spread out across different areas. And as an industry, we've done a very big disservice by labeling our clients small group, large group. So the first thing I like to do is to try and take that stigma away and treat every employer as equal. So the conversation always begins with, let's talk about you. I want to know about you. Tell me about your business. How did you grow it? What's important to you? Where do your employees live? What are their concerns? I have to have a foundation before I could ever have a conversation. So it just starts with getting to know them. And then once we have that conversation, we can start to talk about what's available to you at your size. And that really dictates where they're interested in going with that conversation. There's things you can do for small groups that you should, just because you can do them, you shouldn't necessarily do them, especially if you know a smaller group is not particularly healthy. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have a couple of maternities coming up, anything like that. They don't need to be in a self-funded plan.
Yes, I agree.
Follow up on them. Can they? Yes. Should they? No. Right. And so it's our responsibility as consultants to help them understand what the options are and then direct them, for lack of a better term, direct them, point them in the direction of the plan that is going to suit them, their risk tolerance, their employees, and their demographic the best.
Geography has to play a big part of that, because obviously, if you're in a larger metropolitan area, you may have better access. You may have a more broad-based network to work with as opposed to a rural or a smaller area. I get emails weekly from somebody that is saying, hey, we now have a level-funded plan down to 15 lives with no underwriting. And I just kind of sit back and I think, that's a ticking bomb for a lot of employers. And if the consultant isn't really cued in to all of the pitfalls that can occur there, and they don't take the time to explain the long-term play of making a move like that, it could have catastrophic results for them.
Well, you're absolutely right. A couple things to address in that last statement. I mean, you hit on some really good points. Geography plays a huge part in it. I happen to be in the lovely Pacific Northwest, and we have the Puget Sound that runs through our area. And I talk to vendors on the East Coast. They're like, oh, it's no problem. There's a doctor 20 minutes away. A doctor's not actually 20 minutes away. It is if you're a bird and you can fly across a large body of water and get into downtown Seattle. But if you're a normal person and you have to drive there or take the ferry, that's a couple hours. And so geography is a huge part of it. In Eastern Oregon, there is a big area of Oregon that has one pharmacy. One pharmacy
Serving
a very large geographic area in Oregon. And if you want a prescription filled, it needs to be called in at least a week ahead of time. They're going to call you and tell you your prescription is going to be ready on Thursday. We have no idea what time. And bring your lawn chair, because there's a big group of people sitting out front waiting for their name to be called to pick up their prescription. Vendors in particular, especially in the level funded or self-funded space, have no idea about these problems. They have this overreaching solution, which sounds awesome. And in theory, it is. But you have to also look at the practicality of what's going to really happen to the members of this employer if I implement this program. How are they going to be affected? Are they going to even have access to the one pharmacy in Eastern Oregon?
Yeah. Well, because this information trickles down, and I don't know any business owner that is not trying to find some way to make or generate savings in their group health plan, as some of their ideas make some sense and probably most of them might have some faults. When you're talking to a business owner, and maybe give me an example of how you guide and steer them and keep them on that straight and narrow path so that the end result is not only going to be good for the business owner, but good for the employees.
Well, I think that you need to look at it with a long-term focus and not a short-term focus. So if you're talking to an employer about changing philosophies, let's say the very first easiest step, moving from fully insured to a level funded program, they still need to understand this is not a one-year fix. This is something that you have to understand. You have to explain to them where the money's going. This is the premium you're paying is going into these three different buckets. Here's how much and here's how it works. Unfortunately, and I don't mean to speak disparagingly of my own industry, but unfortunately, there's a lot of consultants, A, that don't tell their employers, because B, they're not even aware. They're just looking at it going, oh, this is less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to educate the employer on, I think this might be a good fit for you because of A, B, and C. But here's the considerations you need to be thinking about. A, you're now a plan fiduciary, the same way as you would be for your 401k plan. If you're on a self-funded or level-funded or however you want to call it, still a form of self-funding.
Right.
Now a plan fiduciary. What is the terminal liability? What's the runout? How long are they going to pay a claim after your contract's ended? Most consultants, unfortunately, in the smaller group space, are not fully educating employers about these risks and concerns because they're not insurmountable. They're easy things to take care of, but it's our responsibility to make sure the employer understands it. And then we talk through what are the ramifications to the members. Is this going to be harder for the member? Are they going to be potentially on the hook for balanced billing? If you're talking about reference-based pricing, particularly, many of the programs say, oh, we guarantee 100% indemnification against any balanced billing. Unfortunately, as we both know, it's still the member who assumes that financial responsibility when they agree to go to a facility or a provider, and they're the ones whose credit is going to be affected. They're the ones who could potentially be sent to collections, and they're the ones that could potentially face legal action. So even though we have this guarantee over here, what does it actually mean? Is it within 30 days you're going to take care of it? Or is it eventually we're going to take care of it? Those are important things to make sure that as a consultant, you thoroughly understand what that contract looks like, what the details are, and then you can explain it not only to the employer, but to their employees and members as well. Because oftentimes the employer will say, okay, that sounds great, but they don't tell the employees this could potentially happen.
Exactly. And my term for that is change management. Anytime you're introducing a concept that directly affects that employee, you have got to have a rock solid communication strategy that is ongoing to be able to ensure that they know and understand what the rules of the road are. I tend to believe that if they know those things, they'll follow the rules. But I have just seen situation after situation where the C-suite makes a decision and drops it on HR's desk, and HR is now thinking, oh gosh, I've got to try and figure out how to communicate this to the frontline managers. The frontline managers are going, I don't have time to deal with this. What do you mean I've got to pull everybody together and have a meeting and talk about this? And it falls apart. And when those things happen, it collapses. You know, the other side that kind of concerns me too on this transition from fully insured to self-funded or level funded is whether or not the employer totally understands the run-in period, whether they totally understand what that first year of claims is really going to look like. And I think that that is a critical component. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I was having a discussion with another consultant in the industry, and I was told that they'd never provided an experience report to their clients for level funding, ever.
Okay.
So a way to avoid the problem with understanding run-in and run-out is communicating on a regular basis.
Right.
The employer, here's what claims are like. This is what it means for you. Here's what claims are like. Here's what it means for you. I just saw a prescription pop up for that is generally used to treat this condition or this disease. This could potentially lead to more claims down the road. Remember, we do have this run-out, but again, it's that reinforcement and constant communication so they understand you're their partner and you're trying to guide them and give them as much information as possible to make the best decisions for their particular situation.
When you're looking at a group and you think that, and I'm going to use the term environment, meaning that the business environment is right to potentially go to some sort of a self-funding or minimum premium arrangement, and they have forever been on a fully insured plan. Other than what we have covered, what are some of the other key important steps initially that they really need to have a good grasp of about how this is going to change and what the impact of this is and what happens if we have $1 million claim, which any group could potentially have?
100%. So they need to understand what their maximum liability is. What is their overall risk? How is that different than their overall risk for a fully insured plan? Because again, whatever their premium is their overall risk. So now we're looking at different components that make up your overall risk. So is this higher or lower than your fully insured? They need to understand that. I mean, from a budgeting standpoint, some months are going to be higher and some months are going to be lower. Can you handle the variance in cash flow? Do you have the cash flow to pay the claims when they need to be paid? Because if you don't, then this is not the right plan for you.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's a qualifier right there. They also need to understand that if they move to this type of program, they're looking at basically a minimum 15% rate increase in the second year because of run-in, what we just talked about.
Right.
In the first 2 to 3 months, claims are not fully mature. They haven't been processed through the system, particularly if there's a hospital claim. They don't get processed for a while. So you don't start seeing mature claims until a few months into the plan year. These carriers price it accordingly. They know they're only going to pay 9.5 months out of a 12-month contract period. So employers need to understand this. If we're looking at this, not only for this year, but moving forward, how is this going to impact you moving forward? And unfortunately, there's always shady players in any industry, and a lot of programs will say, oh no, we've completely factored that in. I've never seen it completely factored in.
Well, I think that it really comes down to the aspect of just obtaining the education that you need if you're going to play in that space, learn it, know it, and understand it. So number one, you don't lose a customer because once that happens, they're lost. It's not really very effective to go back and say, gosh, I'm sorry, but I learned my lesson. May I have another chance, please? You don't want to lose a customer. And the other aspect of that is if you're in that space and you do it right, and you do it right a couple of times, isn't it interesting how that momentum starts to roll downhill? And all of a sudden you hear from this individual that you may have never met that says, hey, you know, I know John Jones and he was telling me what you guys did for him. Do you think it might work for us? It's just a very, very smart way to work. And to gain that knowledge, whether you secure that through NABIP or whether you do it however you want to do it, it is out there.
It's out there.
Yeah, you just have to get it, read it, and understand it, and talk to people that know what they're doing. You know, I've been in the group business for 40 years, and I'll openly admit, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I learned a long time ago that I don't really have to know everything. I just have to know how to get to the people that do. And once you do that and you have these principles down and you understand them, man, it's smooth sailing. Well, let's talk about another situation where you've got a group that is in a self-funded arrangement and the environment just isn't right to take them out of that. So we're staying with our typical, and I use the term bookshelf plan because that's what everybody uses. What kind of ideas and thoughts do you have that you can inject into, because you have, obviously you have a lot less flexibility when you're working with a bookshelf plan, to either help generate savings or to create an environment where the employee sees maybe an improvement to benefits?
We have less options, but it doesn't mean we don't have any options. So HRAs, health reimbursement accounts, are a fabulous tool for working with a fully insured plan, because you can raise deductibles, you can raise out-of-pocket maximums, and you can quote-unquote self-insure, because that's what you're doing with a health reimbursement account. A portion, a small portion. And it's pretty easy to model what that risk is to an employer and say, you know, based on 20% of your employees using it, this is what your risk is, 30%. It's kind of what we do. But we'll do some modeling around that. You can use HSA high deductible health plans, HSA qualified plans. You don't have to pair them with an HSA bank account. Maybe you pair it with a direct primary care contract and put some other things in there and put a little bit of money in an HRA that they can use for lab and x-ray and prescriptions. There are ways to do it, but you need to think about what's the budget, what's the risk tolerance, and what's the educational opportunities with group. Because if they're not going to allow a consultant to actually have a conversation with the employees to explain how all this works together, it's going to not work well.
Exactly.
So it's going to be noisy. It's going to be uncomfortable. Nobody's going to be happy, least of all the employer.
And I think that's 100% of the time. You have to have those ingredients in place and you have to have that scenario happen. Nancy, you mentioned one of my favorite topics, and that's direct primary care. I'm a huge advocate of that. Dr. Josh Umber has been on the show, and he was involved in direct primary care 10 years ago when everybody went, what? But I think the value that that represents is incredible, and the learning curve is basically non-existent. If the employer folds that into a benefit package, and obviously the best situation is for it to be employer funded, but there's nothing that you have to learn about unlimited visits, unlimited conversations, of open access. If you call today, you can probably be seen today. It is the simplest concept in the world. And I think it's a huge component. Do you guys see that growing up in the Northwest?
Yes, actually, direct primary care got its start here in the Seattle area. This company's no longer in business, but it was a large organization, and they supported Microsoft plans back in the day. But yes, the only issue we have in our particular state, and a few other states face this as well, is that medical cost sharing is not allowed in our state. So it makes it a little bit more challenging to pair a fully insured plan with direct primary care. Again, doesn't mean it can't be done. You just have to know your numbers. But the average in-person direct primary care runs $100 PEPM. You can go down, you can get a virtual direct primary care, which, you know, you might be able to get for 20, 25, but so you just have to make your numbers work. Where are you trying to get to, and how do we make that work? Or does it not work?
Well, I guess the only good thing that came out of COVID was the awareness level that it brought to telemedicine. That's been a component of health plans for years. Nobody ever used it. Nobody paid any attention to it. Now, all of a sudden, well, I can't go to the doctor, but I don't feel good. What do I do? And now it's kind of become the standard model. I talk to a lot of our members that they're, man, if they can't get what they need on telemedicine, they're now disappointed. Oh, geez, I guess I got to go in. So I think that, and that feeds into that DPC, that whole DPC concept, and I think it's great. The other thing that obviously is problematic in every plan, and this is some type of self-funding or fully insured plans, is prescription drug costs. What ideas do you share with your clients on ways that they can help with prescription drug costs?
Oh, you just speak in my language. This is one that I have been hammering for 20 years with my employers and my employees. And back before GoodRx, which we'll touch on that in a minute, but back before GoodRx, I used to do comparisons. I would give employees printed out comparisons of pricing out drugs at different pharmacies. And the disparity was huge.
Oh, yeah.
But now I tell people all the time, I'm like, look your drug up on GoodRx. Find out what the cash price is. And when you get to the pharmacy, find out what they're going to charge you through the insurance. And if it's less expensive, do not run it through your insurance.
Exactly.
Because there's no point. I'm that person no one wants to stand behind at the pharmacy. Because I always get up there and they're like, well, that'll be $300. I'm like, no, it's not.
No, hang on a minute.
It's $67 on GoodRx. And they're like, all right, I'll run it back through. And so people are like, well, don't you want it to count towards your deductible? I personally am on a high deductible health plan. No, I don't. I would rather pay $240 less out of my pocket than have it count towards some deductible I may or may not meet.
Exactly. And I am a huge advocate of that. And I happen to be one of those Medicare folks. So when it comes to, you know, the antibiotics and the things that we all go through.
I sell a lot of Medicare. I know all the, I mean, I sit there and educate people across my desk every day. I'm like, of course, we always have to find out what prescriptions they take so that we can help steer them in the right direction. And if they're taking 5 generic prescriptions, I'm like, let's buy the least expensive prescription drug plan and you can pay cash for these because you're going to come out ahead.
Bingo. 100% of the time. And I had to get a topical antibiotic a couple of weeks ago and the pharmacist called me and said, it's ready. It's $83. And I said, well, I doubt it, but I'll see you in a little bit.
Yeah.
GoodRx, $31.50. And I just preach this over and over. It is so easy to use.
So easy to use. I mean, I tell everybody that comes in here, you know, obviously Medicare is an older population. And I'm like, give me your phone. Let me put it on here for you. Look it up. And you have it right here in your hand. And I think it's an absolutely invaluable tool. There, of course, are manufacturer's coupons, manufacturer's assistance programs. Look up your drug. Go to the website. See how you can pay less. See if there is an alternative. Don't be afraid to ask your doctor because that pharmaceutical rep might just have been in their office the day before. And so that's the top of their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might ask your doctor, well, do you have any idea what the average cost of this is? Pretty much they're going to play dumb most of the time. But you can just say, you know, I'm on a HSA plan or I'm on a limited budget or whatever it is that you need to say. Is there a generic alternative or are there less expensive alternatives that you're aware of that might work for me?
Absolutely.
Now, if the doctor says no, then you're like, okay, at least you know. But it's okay to ask the question of your doctor.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of times, if you have a relationship with a pharmacist and the doctor is like, I don't know if there's a generic. I don't know. We're going to do this. Ask your pharmacist and call your doctor back and say, hey, can I take this instead? Well, yeah, I guess. Okay, well, I just saved myself $180.
And yeah, and that's a really good point too. Go to a pharmacy that has an actual pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our large chain pharmacies, although they have a pharmaceutical degree, they're not advising patients other than, do you have any questions? You know, that's their consultation. But if you go to an independent pharmacist or one where you know that there's a pharmacist that cares, go there, establish a relationship with your pharmacist is just as important as your relationship with your doctor.
I could not agree more because they know more about the prescription side of the world than the physician does, in my opinion, and they can help you and guide you.
You know, the same thing applies, Mike, for if your doctor says, hey, you need to get an MRI or you need to get an ultrasound, here's a referral to the place across the street or across the hall, because that's in their system. They're going to get paid more on it. There's no reason to ask your doctor, can you give me any written prescription so I can maybe get it less expensively?
And Nancy, I think 90% of the time you can.
You can.
I helped a friend that was facing a $1,200 MRI get that same test done for about, what was it, $310. All you got to do is just ask. And just, you got to be proactive. And when you are, that works. We're about out of time. What have we missed?
Okay, we have missed one thing, and it actually goes back to you, because the one thing that people forget in the small group market when they're moving from fully insured to self-insured is ACA compliance. A lot of people completely forget about that. They forget to explain to their clients that there's going to be additional compliance steps that they need to take, and they need to be, as a broker consultant in that small group market, if you move them that direction, it is really your responsibility to make sure that they are following those steps, because they're not going to know how to do it on their own.
Absolutely correct. And self-funded plans play under different rules, regardless of the size of the employer. And there are reporting requirements on self-funded plans, even if you've got that group of 15. Uh-huh. So you're 100% right. And again, that's information that's out there and it's easy to access. You just have to invest the time to look it up and to find it and implement it into your processes. Well, Nancy, gosh, I appreciate it so much. I enjoy listening to your, and I'm probably going to say this wrong, your 2-Minute Tuesdays.
You said it right.
Okay. I caught the one on AI. Scares me too. If you have played with any of these, which I have done, if you've played with any of these AI applications, it's amazing. I'll say that, but it's kind of frightening. And my immediate thought was, my God, where was this when I was in college? That's going to be the next big issue. But thanks a ton for being on the show. I know I'm going to get pings and people are going to ask questions about, you said this or we talked about this. How do they reach you?
I'm always available on LinkedIn, Nancy Giacalone on LinkedIn. That starts with G-I-A. So just for clarification, you can also email me directly at nancy@olympiccrest.com.
Awesome. Well, again, I appreciate it. When do they make, because we're doing this in early May, when do they make the determination on the 2023 Broker of the Year Award?
Next week.
Oh.
Next week.
All right.
I'm leaving for Atlanta on Sunday, so I'm excited.
I got my fingers crossed. I hope it goes your way. Thanks again, and let's connect again sometime down the road.
That would be fun. Thank you for the opportunity, Mike.
All right. Appreciate it.
Well, the only bad news today is that we're at the end of the show. So thanks for listening to the Business of Health podcast. Listening to this show puts your agency in position for success. Remember to click the link below, check out my website at www.firststaffbenefits.com. Give me a shout. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Keep listening, keep learning, and keep taking action. Until next time, this is Mike Martins signing off.